This is Kathleen Newland, speaking to you from the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where I am a senior fellow. And I'd like to welcome you all to a webinar entitled A New Era in Refugee Protection and Migration Management, Looking Forward After the UN Refugee and Migrants Summit. As you know, the UN held a multilateral conference on large movements of refugees and migrants on last Monday, September 19th. And here to discuss the outcomes and the prospects resulting from that conference, I have two people who've been deeply involved in refugee and migration issues for many years and who were much involved in the summit itself. Gregory Maniatis is a senior European policy fellow at MPI and an advisor to Peter Sutherland, the special representative of the UN Secretary General for International Migration. We also have T. Alexander Alenikoff, also an MPI senior fellow, who is visiting professor of law at Columbia Law School and the Huo Global Policy Initiative Research Fellow at Columbia's Global Policy Initiative. As many of you know, Alex was formerly the UN Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees. Before we get into the substance of this call, I'd like to just make a couple of housekeeping notes. First, to let you know that the audio from this webinar will be on our website later today at migrationpolicy.org/events. So if you're unable to stay with us for the full time or want to refer colleagues to this webinar, that's where you can find the full transcript. There are also a number of related reports, resources, articles on the issue of refugee protection and migration management on our website, which can be found at www.migrationpolicy.org/transatlantic and at other places on the website. If you have technical problems, please email events@migrationpolicy.org, or you can call +1 202-266-1929 and get some advice about how to resolve those problems. If you have problems hearing via the web, please dial in using the call information sent to you via email. We'll have a Q&A at the end of the call, but this will not be a voice Q&A. So please type any questions that you have into the Q&A or chat box on the right side of your screen and send to the host, or you can email them to events@migrationpolicy.org. You can also tweet your questions to @migrationpolicy or #MPIDiscuss. So that's a lot of housekeeping, but now we'll get into the substance. As I said, on last Monday, the United Nations General Assembly held a summit on large movements of refugees and migrants. This was unprecedented for the United Nations to devote a high-level segment of the General Assembly to migration and refugees alone. There's been a great deal of reluctance to discuss these issues in a formal multilateral setting. So this was itself a big development. It produced an outcome document, which is a beautiful thing to read. It includes almost every commitment and point you could wish to hear about how states are going to respect the human rights of migrants and refugees, how they're going to provide them with needed assistance, how they're going to protect their lives, rescue them at sea, and make sure that they have good prospects going forward. But in that document, there are very few specific commitments, and that has led some people to feel frustrated with the outcome of the summit. One commitment that was made is that the states agreed to enter into a process that will lead to two global compacts, a global compact on refugees and a global compact on migration, to be delivered and discussed and, one hopes, adopted by 2018. I'd like to turn now to Gregory Maniatis and ask how this summit came about. How did we get to the points where states were actually willing to have this conversation at the United Nations?
Thank you, Kathleen, and thanks, everyone. It's a really good place to start because the summit, which was held last Monday, began in terms of its impetus last summer, in the summer of 2015. And while there were other crises in the Andaman Sea and a long-term refugee crisis in Africa and parts of Asia, there's a crisis in Central America around unaccompanied minors coming to the United States, and not only. The real impetus for the UN summit last Monday was the Mediterranean crisis. So it was principally driven by what was happening there with thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands of people crossing the Mediterranean. And when Peter Sutherland vigorously argued for a conference beginning last summer, for the summit, the goal was to create a comprehensive plan of action for that Mediterranean crisis, and a comprehensive plan of action that would muster global resources in the form of resettlement and aid in order to be able to take care of the people who were risking their lives to cross the sea. In order to not make it seem like a one-time event and not have it be a one-time event, there was a broader goal as well, which was to use a comprehensive plan of action in the Mediterranean as a model for future crises and as a model, as a template for determining responsibility sharing for such crises in the future. So that was what the original vision was. I think if you look at it from that perspective, you cannot say that the summit last Monday was a success. There was a second summit that was called by the United States, by President Obama, the following day, which did provide very specific commitments that relate to the current situation, the current crisis. It increased resettlement offers from states. It increased humanitarian financing for the crisis, but it was a one-time set of commitments that are not systemically important.
Right. So,
go on. No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. It's you mentioned the summit the day after. It's often true with these large multilateral conferences that the real action takes place beforehand, when the procedures and indeed the outcome documents are negotiated, or afterwards when there's some follow-up or not, and around the edges. So putting those things together, the Obama summit, the UN summit, I mean, what's your overall assessment of this, your personal assessment? Do you think you said it wasn't a success in terms of Peter Sutherland's original goals for the conference, but were there other things that that you think are genuinely noteworthy?
Sure, and I think that there was potential created by the summit. I think on the refugee side, and Alex can speak to that with much greater authority, my perspective is that essentially the refugee system dates to 1951 is threadbare right now, that this summit did not go a long way or any way at all in terms of really reinforcing the political commitment that states need to have in order to bring the 1951 Convention into the 21st century. It has been expanded over the years through legal precedent, strategically, but I think we've left publics and politicians behind with respect to the importance of the Refugee Convention, and I think now we're seeing it being very seriously eroded in many ways or ignored. But I think in terms of, and there's a chance with the Global Compact on Refugees that that process will lead to greater support for the refugee system. The surprise in some ways of the past year was that although, as I said, the initial impetus for the summit was the Mediterranean crisis, the constituency at the United Nations, the member states, were far more interested in migration. So even though the the initial title of the summit was actually it was a summit on large-scale movements of refugees and migrants. That seems to indicate that we're dealing with crises. The ultimate both title of the summit, which was the UN Summit on Refugees and Migrants, and the outcome document that you alluded to earlier, really focus on migration and refugees writ large. And on the migration side, what we saw was that the member states of the United Nations were not willing to host a summit that was only on refugees. The constituency for refugee issues in the UN system at the member state level is fairly small. The constituency that wants to see migration addressed at the member state level is very big. And so what we had was this hybrid summit that addressed both issues. And I think in some ways, the migration side was much more progressive. We've seen over the past decade fairly steady progress on migration at the international level. There have been several high water marks.
I want to come back to that, but I want to ask you one more thing before we bring sure. Alex in. One of the very few specific outcomes of this summit was that the UN member states agreed to incorporate the International Organization for Migration into the UN system. Now, IOM was not a UN agency, although it has over 160 member states. It has by far the largest capacity on migration of any international organization. And so now the UN has some capacity on migration. Is this something really important, or is it just a question of juggling the boxes?
Oh, I think it is important, and it's something that Peter Sutherland has championed since he came into office in 2006. And getting the IOM into the UN system gives a voice for migrants and migration issues at the international level on equal footing with other issues. And to allow the IOM to be integrated into not only the debate at the highest levels of the UN, but also in the field to work hand in hand with other agencies to address migration-related challenges is significant. Now, just as with the global compacts that have been set out, the integration of the IOM into the UN system and the actual impact of those will depend on what happens over the course of the coming 2-3 years. All of these processes can be basically just status quo with different headlines on them, or we could see real progress as a result of the compacts and of the IOM's integration into the UN. But certainly IOM in the UN is an important step forward.
Great. Thank you, Gregory. As you said, a lot of the focus in the summit, or at least a lot of the news out of the summit, was about migration, but it gave equal emphasis to large movements of refugees. And Alex, you, of course, having been Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees in the UN, have tremendous perspective on how the refugee question has been dealt with. As Gregory said, the UN summit was not considered a roaring success in reconfirming the 1951 Refugee Convention, but we heard such a widespread of opinion afterwards from the Secretary General of Amnesty International describing the summit as a catastrophic failure, to others describing it as a breakthrough. Which end of that spectrum are you closer to at this point?
Well, I'm probably somewhere in the middle, of course. I think that in terms of dealing with the immediate problems, very little was accomplished, as Gregory said. I don't think there was a major breakthrough in terms of the fundamental fixes to the system created in 1951 that are now needed. On the other hand, I think there is an opening for further work here that could make a difference. I don't think a lot is different the day after the summit, except the fact that we may have now a 2-year process going forward to think about this compact on refugees. I think it is worth noting, however, that the summits happened in a very tough time politically, and in many countries people are well aware of the the populist politics that are quite virulent in many states now. And so to have a UN meeting at the very highest levels that affirms the importance of the 51 Convention, the importance of refugee protection, notes the benefits of migration, seeks to facilitate migration and protect vulnerable migrants and provide rescue at sea. These are things that could not necessarily have been taken for granted. The world might have gotten together and say it's time to fundamentally cut back on refugee protection or leave migration up to the individual states in the interest of their sovereignty, et cetera. That didn't happen. We kind of have a ratchet here, or we drew a line upon which a foundation upon which more can be built. And as I said, we will have these two compacts going forward, one on migration, one on refugees, that will allow for the kind of further deliberation that's necessary to get the international consensus to move forward. One other way, if I could, for I think that there was a important affirmation of what in fact has been a change is in the refugee protection system. There has been a recognition over a number of years, in fact going back 20, 30 years, about the importance of the role of development actors, and a lot of that has been words without much progress. I think there's been real progress in recent years now of thinking about comprehensive analysis and planning and action among humanitarian actors, development actors, private sector, and others, and that comprehensive approach is which would have been, I wouldn't say controversial, but certainly not the common wisdom a couple of years ago. I think now is firmly ingrained in the way the international community thinks the refugee system has to move forward. And that is a noticeable shift in discourse and probably now in organization.
And I know, Alex, that you were very much involved in pushing that orientation within UNHCR and reaching out to the development agencies there. And I agree with you that that's one of the shifts that has taken place really outside the bounds of this conference process, but which frames it in an important way.
The outcome document does, the New York Declaration does talk about UNHCR's responsibility now for developing a comprehensive response framework, and that really does signal that broader plan. So I think it's embedded within the documents and the plans going forward. And you mentioned the work of UNHCR here in pushing this, which is true, but I think one of the real game changers has been the new role of the World Bank, recognizing the importance of getting involved in situations of displacement and putting significant resources behind doing that. That takes it a bit outside the usual UN structure, which I think is also a good thing, because I don't think these are problems that can be dealt with simply among the multilateral UN organizations.
Yes. Another interesting development in the last not so many years, just maybe even the last two or three, in addition to the development actors involved, we've seen much greater engagement by the private sector, both individuals. You know, we've seen individuals opening their homes, providing assistance to the refugees who are traipsing up through the Balkans and into Western Europe. We've seen large corporations like IKEA and Airbnb getting involved, directly involved with refugees. And you were very involved in putting together a private sector summit the day after the UN summit. Can you tell us a little bit about what you hope to accomplish with that, and what that private sector summit was about?
I'd be happy to, and then I'd like to turn it over to Gregory, who was really front and center on having this thing go forward. But the idea here was that there really were other actors on the outside who should be brought into the tent on responding and not leave this up simply to the traditional UN humanitarian organizations and large NGOs. And there's a lot of money in the private sector, more importantly, a lot of interest, both in terms of doing good and corporate social responsibility, but even now more importantly in terms of possible investment opportunities if the opportunities present themselves. So We held a well-attended event on a range of different topics, such as how to get private investment into refugee hosting areas, private sponsorship of a settlement, greater connectivity for refugees in refugee hosting areas, how to involve the private sector in what we said was changing the discourse on refugees around the world. And I think unlike the U.S. summit, which attempted to sign up specific commitments, company X would come in and say, we will now hire so many refugees going forward or provide an internet connection for people in this particular location. We really focused on changing the models of behavior here that could create public-private partnerships going forward. I think Gregory can say a lot about the commitment of George Soros, for example, to invest
yes.
$500 million with private sector entities seeking to assist refugees and migrants. But the goal of the summit here is not simply to display examples of things happening, but to change our mindset about how to fully bring in the private sector as a partner that can be a very powerful partner. But over to you,
yes,
Gregory.
Yes, and this is something that trying to involve the private sector with refugees and migrants is, you know, it's an effort that's been going on for 8 or 10 years and has not been very successful until very recently. And Gregory, I saw you sitting on the stage with George Soros at the beginning of this private sector summit as he pledged to invest $500 million in startups and established businesses and other innovative things that are run by or for refugees and migrants. What accounts for that change from a great reluctance to get involved on the part of the private sector to now a really important set of initiatives?
That's a good question. I want to, if you don't mind, just take it a little more broadly for a minute, which is that
sure.
the goal with Concordia was to try to both
Concordia of this private sector summit.
This private sector summit was to mobilize a broader constituency to be active on the refugee and migration crises. This was an attempt to both rally them, to show others from the world of the business world, the philanthropic world, the NGO world, what was happening and what they could do, but also to signal to political leaders who were gathered in New York that other actors, other stakeholders cared about what was happening, had the capacity to respond, but also expected them to respond. And I think that's the broader point, that we're living in a moment now where we're seeing migration and refugee policy renationalized. So when you have national politicians dealing with this issue in a very public way, their focus is on security. Their focus is on making sure that their publics, the voters, issues that as they see it are addressed, and that's national security issues, economic and cultural issues. But that is a very distorted lens through which to see migration, and migrants have become scapegoated as a result. So the goal in the context of this renationalization is to mobilize other actors, individuals, businesses, NGOs, philanthropists, to understand that at the national level, progress is not going to be made very easily and that we all need to act. And so Concordia was, and that summit was organized in that spirit to try to get other actors to step up and to make the political classes understand that migrants and refugees should not be scapegoated. In terms of the specific initiative that you mentioned that George Soros is leading and has made a commitment that he announced last Tuesday to invest up to $500 million in businesses that address challenges related to migration and refugee issues. So for instance, how do you get healthcare services to people on the move? How do you reduce the costs and the risks related to migration? For instance, remittance costs remain very high. There are ways to reduce those costs. How do you get people engaged in refugee resettlement? These are all issues that I think the private sector can play a very important role in addressing, and that by providing his private capital. This is not an effort of his foundation. This is his own private capital. As an incentive, I think Mr. Soros hopes to motivate the private sector to become more involved.
Thanks very much, Gregory. I'd like to go back a bit, unless there's anything you want to add on this, Alex, to the UN summit. But before I do that, let me remind those of you who are listening that you can put questions to any of the three of us. Type them into the Q&A or the chat box on the right side of your screen, or you can send them to events@migrationpolicy.org, and they'll be relayed to me. So looking back at the meeting among governments, which is, as both of you mentioned, pledged to negotiate two compacts, one on refugees and one on migration, by 2018. Does this just mean that nothing's going to happen in the next 2 years? Is this just a way of sort of kicking the can down the road? Or do you expect that there will be really serious negotiations on concrete commitments? Let's start with you, Alex, on that one, if I may.
Yeah, I mean, this remains to be seen, quite frankly. When I'm always optimistic, but frequently disappointed. So I think on the migration, I think it may be easier on the refugee side than migration side for the following reasons. The migration side, as Gregory noted, expanded well beyond the emergencies of large-scale movements and was seen ultimately as almost a bridge to the sustainable development goals. How does migration as a whole relate to development? How does it adopt it as one of its major goals, one of the targets of the SDGs to develop orderly and regular migration? It's a very broad agenda, and the document includes a dozen or two dozen elements that should be considered, all of which will now go into a state-led process, meaning there'll be a couple of states that step forward and are designated as running the negotiations. There'll be a secretariat of UN organizations or one UN organization that will help drive it. But given the range of issues and the range of states, the idea that we'll and the contentiousness of the issues, the idea that we'll get something substantial in the year, year and a half we really have to develop it, I think is not likely, but there could be some progress. On the refugee side, the process is not a state-led process. It's gone back to UNHCR, and UNHCR has been asked to develop a compact on refugees. It's unclear exactly what that compact's supposed to be about. You could read the document one way, saying really it's simply supposed to be about the comprehensive response framework that is identified in the annex to the outcome document and the document itself, which is the new way that UNHCR should be coordinating and working with a range of actors on the ground in particular situations. Or the compact could be a broader document that talks about global responsibility sharing, tries to come up with a formula for allocating that kind of responsibility, talks about new norms, other kinds of vulnerable migrants and people in refugee-like situations who could be protected. That's unclear. Because you have a single actor writing it, UNHCR, it will be a more coherent. On the other hand, it may be more limited because UNHCR may be much more focused simply on its operations on the ground and unable to put together the political kind of leadership that would be required to have these broader fixes to the overall refugee system. But I actually, quite frankly, think that the goal for all of us on this call and all of us listening is to take these documents seriously and try to push in the various ways we can to make sure that they come up with concrete, substantial, and in some places fundamental changes to systems that really are quite broken at the moment.
Yes, when I think about these global compacts, I've been sort of thinking about the process that led to the Paris Accords on climate change. And, you know, it was 24 years ago that we saw the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiated and opened for ratification. So, you know, Gregory, is this going to take 24 years to get us to some concrete commitments on migration?
It's a good It's a good question. I think there is an analogy to be had between migration and environmental issues. I don't know whether we're in the 70s or the 80s with respect to migration and that analogy, but it's certainly a long way to go. But in terms of the Global Compact on Migration, there, I think, is real potential to make it meaningful, not in necessarily a massive way, but we have, over the past several years, been able to articulate at the international level, at the UN, a series of goals that the summit this past week transformed into commitments. Now, these are high-level commitments principally negotiated by diplomats that say we should, for instance, end child detention, or we should reduce the cost of remittances. And all those are commitments without any real plan behind them. So I think a modest goal for the Global Compact is to focus not on the what we're committed to doing, but on the how we're going to do it, and to rally small communities of stakeholders led by states around each of those goals. So we might not get 190 plus states to do things by 2018, but we can create templates by having small groups of states and other stakeholders solve some of the problems that are eminently solvable and are pointed to in the Global Compact. So if the states spend the next 2 years simply having diplomats negotiate the language, which has already been articulated, but reframing it and having meeting after meeting, workshop after workshop, just simply at that level, it will not make any progress. But if individual policymakers, senior civil servants in states say, hey, I'm going to do something about this, like the United States and the Philippines did over the past couple of years to create a plan of action for migrants who are caught in countries in crisis, as happened in Libya in 2011, and there were migrants stranded there and we didn't know what to do with them, they came up with a plan for that. If we can develop plans for the specific problems and challenges and states sign up to those plans, at least a few, then we'll have gotten somewhere.
I think that's yes, Alex, please.
To come in on that, I think there are different strategies for change, and some are to solve particular problems and then to see how those add up to a slow change in the way we think about things. Another way is to come up with ambitious goals like the MDGs all at once, or the SDGs, and try to get global processes working that way. Another way is to define a broader vision of where you would like to move to. I think we'll try all of those and see which of those work ultimately. What I think is going to be create the headwind here is are very strong notions in the UN. Two very strong notions. One is state sovereignty, and immigration is really seen as a sovereign function of the state that the international community should not be messing with, if I can put it that way, very much. And the second is the fact that the way these documents have been written is that, at least on the refugee side, it was originally turned over to the UN organizations responsible for care and maintenance of refugees, and it's very hard to get a significant shift in the system if the agencies that are currently in the middle of the system are asked to write, because UN agencies will typically work within existing paradigms and seek to protect their turf. So the question is whether we really need a break here in the way we're approaching these problems. Do we need a fundamental shift in the way we describe these problems and the global kinds of processes that need to go forward? I don't think that what we have will get us there, but people may disagree whether we need that kind of break or whether we should be continuing to work within a system of sovereign nation states and sovereign UN organizations that will tinker at the margins, perhaps improve people's lives, hopefully, in significant ways, but not take the system as a whole and shake it and say, where do we really need to go in the mid-21st century?
Yeah, I think it's an important point that you raised, Alex, but I think that that you're right that probably both the big picture and the smaller scale initiatives or more specific initiatives will go forward at the same time. And I think those the more specific initiatives can provide a form of confidence building for states that international cooperation can really be a problem solver for them rather than them giving something away that they can gain through cooperating with other states, even to the point of combining some decision making about the framework for migration, maybe falling short of legally binding rules, but opening more space for mutual cooperation. I know Peter Sutherland is fond of describing this as mini multilateralism, where you just start with the number of states that you need to get things done, and then hopefully when they see positive outcomes, more states will join in and form these partnerships with new actors as well. We do have one. We have a couple of questions which I'd like to turn to. One of them, I think, is very U.S. specific. A listener is hoping that we could tell the audience where to find a resource or a document that would explain the refugee screening process. The process seems a bit opaque, this person said, and I'd like to be able to answer more comprehensively when people ask me, are refugees really being screened through some security apparatus? And I'd like to direct that listener to a hearing that was held on the Hill this past week in the context of the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, at which a senior official from the Department of Homeland Security testified and gave quite a comprehensive description of the refugee screening process. So I think if you go to DHS.gov and look for recent congressional testimony, you'll find that. There's another question. It says, the panelists talked about the future of private sponsorship in the U.S. Is there any look towards setting up private sponsorship among religious groups or households that has potential for implementation? Gregory, you were at the you've been involved in these discussions, as have I, as has Alex. Either of you like to comment on that?
Well, Kathleen, maybe
sure.
You should
go ahead.
Maybe you should comment. You've been in the middle of it.
Yeah. Well, I the answer is I think there is some outlook toward private sponsorship in the United States and in other countries. The Canadian government has long, since the late 70s, sort of been the gold standard on private sponsorship, and they announced last week that they were willing to share their experience with countries that are interested in setting up private sponsorship programs. And the Canadian Minister of Citizenship and Immigration said that 13 countries had expressed such an interest in learning about the Canadian experience with a view toward potentially setting up their own programs. We also heard the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration say that the U.S. State Department, which is involved in our refugee resettlement program, is interested in establishing a pilot project on private sponsorship. So I think there is more interest, and it may deliver some results sooner rather than later. One more question. Alex, you mentioned systematic shifts required to effectively meet refugees' needs. And the questioner here wants to know if you could be more specific, whether you're talking about UNHCR's mandate or, as you mentioned, getting the development and humanitarian actors working together, or is it about multi-annual financing? Where do you see some of the starting points on that?
Well, although the focus for these summits and the motivation for them was the crises at sea and on land, an equally large problem are long-standing, protracted situations. Millions of people stay refugees, and tens of millions internally displaced people for many, many years. And one of the problems of the 1951 Convention, while it was provides a robust set of rights for people recognized as refugees, it really does not do much on establishing a responsibility-sharing system for the world as a whole, or for dealing with these long-term situations which have arisen. UNHCR's response and the humanitarian response has been to deliver more humanitarian aid, although that tends to drop over years. And so we still have situations with people in camps or elsewhere who are still being provided humanitarian assistance 20, 30 years after becoming refugees, even though humanitarian assistance is normally thought of as emergency assistance. So you need to move beyond what is called the care and maintenance model to one that tries to achieve self-sufficiency for refugees, inclusion of refugees into local health systems and education systems, and then eventually solutions. That's not going to happen in hosting states unless hosting states are given an incentive, a financial incentive, to do that, and that financial incentive is going to have to come from largely from development actors who recognize that refugees in hosting states provide a development challenge, or that development area-wide development for refugee hosting areas can make sense in terms of providing funding to benefit both the hosting community and refugees by building infrastructure, by creating jobs and the like that can lift the entire region. So those are the kinds of plans that UNHCR is now currently working out with the World Bank and at several different places around the world, which I think are very strong examples. That model, though, has to be made more than a set of pilots into a new way of doing business, and then there needs to be accountability structure that actually brings that home.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that explanation, Alex. Typically, with only a few minutes left, we have several more questions that have come in, so let me just put them on the table, and I think maybe the first one Gregory might want to address, it is how compatible is current EU approach, is our current EU approaches to migration policies. This is the compacts with Lebanon, Jordan, countries in the Sahel region, Turkey, et cetera, with the global compact. So how compatible is the EU approach with the global compact approach? Think about that for a second, Gregory. There's another question. At both summits, there was a noticeable absence of any conversation about the Central American migrant crisis. Why do you think there wasn't a focus on this region, particularly the Northern Triangle? And Alex, maybe you could take that one in the context of the U.S. Asylum. And finally, questioner points out that about 100 civil society organizations did a scorecard that unpacked and assessed 7 key parts of the New York Declaration, that's the outcome document, and their assessments range from a negative on the Global Compact on Refugees to somewhat positive on the Global Compact on Migration and a campaign against xenophobia. The question is, now is MPI or the UN or anybody else thinking of doing a sum of the summits assessment that puts together not just commitments in the New York Declaration, but also the Obama summit, the private sector summits, especially if those two might have been the first test or examples of taking commitments beyond the 19th. So very quickly, we only have a couple of minutes left. Could you, Gregory, talk about Europe for just in a sentence or two, and then Alex, Central America? And I'll try to come back to that very excellent suggestion about a sum of the summits. Gregory?
Sure. So I think the Europeans are, and the plans that they have are trying to do one thing which is necessary, and that is bring some order to the chaos of arrivals in Europe. Certainly they have every right to make sure that those who do not have a right to be in Europe are not there, but they're doing two things fundamentally wrong at the same time. They believe that scapegoating migrants is essentially what European policy is about today, and scapegoating even worse, scapegoating refugees. And that is what we hear out of Europe for the most part, if you exclude Germany and maybe one or two other countries. The effect of that is is creating support for far-right, anti-liberal, anti-migrant movements in Europe. So much of European policy today is abetting the rise of the far-right, and that is a tragic mistake historically. And the second flaw is that while you have every right to, you know, keep people out who aren't supposed to be there, you also have every obligation to support refugees in the world. And right now, as Peter Sutherland often says, that support is defined by proximity. So countries that are close to conflicts are the ones who bear the burden. The EU has simply not done what it needs to do to support refugees closer to conflicts. And until it corrects that, it will not, no matter how many deals it has with Turkey and the others, it will not be able to control the situation.
All right, thank you very much. Alex, any thoughts on why Central America wasn't mentioned in this summit?
I'm not sure about the why. I agree with the questioner that it's an important issue, and whatever goes forward on the compacts has to think about that kind of flow. The U.S. has generally not characterized the flow as a refugee flow. I think it's pretty clear there that a large number, perhaps a majority of people coming, are in need of some kind of international protection. I think one of the problems with the way the New York Declaration divides up various categories is they put the vulnerable migrants category on the migration side rather than seeing these refugee-like flows on the refugee side, which could lead to some kinds of new norms, a new protocol that wouldn't reopen the definition of refugee but nonetheless provide refugee-like protections to people clearly with international protection needs. I don't think the summit documents got that right.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to take that last question about doing an assessment of some of the summits as an excellent suggestion coming from John Bingham of ICMC, as usual, a very constructive suggestion. And if our speakers will indulge me, just two closely related questions have come in that we might want to address. And I'll combine them. One says, regarding the President's summit, do you have a sense of who will, quote, carry the torch, unquote, in expanding avenues for successful resettlement, given that the Obama administration is exiting? And another, which says that civil society organizations, non-governmental organizations, are arguably the most effective actors on the ground in many regions and have significant experience to contribute to the development of the global compacts. Could we speak to the possible avenues, official or unofficial, for the CSO and NGO engagement in this process? So who's going to carry the torch, and will civil society and NGOs be involved in it? Last words?
I defer to Gregory on these.
Okay, Gregory?
Well, I think in terms of expanding resettlement and doing what is needed to provide protection. Clearly, I think you have, Canada has done a great job on that. Germany has also done an enormous amount. And I think you need to have a coalition of states that use their diplomatic pressure on other states to make sure that resettlement capacity and humanitarian aid are increased drastically over the coming years. In terms of NGO involvement, I couldn't agree more. They're the ones who have not only provided actual capacity on the ground, but they've provided the moral leadership to be able to respond to the crisis. Look at what's happening in the Mediterranean. It is private sector, often individuals and NGOs, that have been saving people in the Mediterranean when states would not. So I think there are ways for them to be involved. I think they should just seize the initiative in terms of starting debates in capitals and in New York about what the compact should be. They shouldn't wait for others.
Yes, and I think that the Global Forum on Migration and Development, which will take place in December in Dhaka this year, is a great opening for the civil society days of that forum to express themselves and to come up with the ideas which they unquestionably have about how to take these processes forward. In closing, I just want to apologize to those in the audience who had trouble connecting with the webinar because of an incorrect link at the beginning, and I just want to remind you that we will have a recording of the entire webinar available later today at at migrationpolicy.org/events. So thank you, Alex. Thank you, Gregory. And thank you very much to our participants for this initial discussion about the summits on migrants and refugees. And we will certainly continue our analysis and scrutiny of these events with your help. Thank you very much.